10. Crowding and leaping. If we dump the ballast, we'll be there in no time. Teaching the workshop where I first tried out the exercises in this book, I began to think about an aspect of narrative technique that I hadn't yet addressed. It has to do with what is included in a story and what is omitted. It has to do with details. It has to do with focus, the focus of the sentence, the paragraph, the piece as a whole. I call it crowding and leaping because those words describe the process in a physical way, which I like. Crowding is what Keats meant when he told poets to load every rift with ore. It's what we mean when we exhort ourselves to avoid flabby language and clichés, never to use 10 vague words where 2 exact words will do, always to seek the vivid phrase, the exact word. By crowding, I mean also keeping the story full, always full of what's happening in it, keeping it moving, not slacking and wandering into irrelevancies, keeping it interconnected with itself, rich with echoes forward and backward, vivid, exact, concrete, accurate, dense, rich. These adjectives describe a prose that is crowded with sensations, meanings, and implications. But leaping is just as important. What you leap over is what you leave out. And what you leave out is infinitely more than what you leave in. There's got to be white space around the word. Silence around the voice. Listing is not describing. Only the relevant belongs. Some say God is in the details. Some say the devil is in the details. Both are correct. If you try to include everything in a description, you end up like poor Funes, the Memorious, in Borges's story of that title, which, if you have not read it, I recommend with all my heart. Overcrowded descriptions clog the story and suffocate themselves. For an example of a novel choked to death by words, look at Salammbô by Gustave Flaubert. Flaubert has been set up as such a universal model, and his bon juste has been made into such a shibboleth that it's salutary to watch the poor man founder in a quicksand consisting entirely of mot juste. Tactically speaking, I'd say go ahead and crowd in the first draft. Tell it all. Blab, babble, put everything in. Then, in revising, consider what merely pads or repeats or slows or impedes your story and cut it. Decide what counts, what tells, and cut and recombine till what's left is what counts. Leap boldly. Action writers often crowd but fail to leap fast enough or far enough. We've all read descriptions of a fist fight or a battle or a sports event, which, by trying to give a blow-by-blow account, merely create confusion and boredom. There's an inherent sameness to much action. The hero cuts off one knight's head, then another, and mere violence doesn't make it interesting. For a magnificent example of action writing, look at any of the sea battles in Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin novels. Everything the reader needs to know is included, but nothing more. At each moment, we know exactly where we are and what's happening. Every detail both enriches the picture and speeds the action. The language is transparent. The sensory details are intense, brief, precise. And you can't stop reading till it's over. It's amazing how long a story a really skilled writer can tell in a few words. Consider example 18, The Life of Mr. Floyd, as told by Virginia Woolf. Mr. Floyd, the schoolmaster, who is 8 years younger than Mrs. Flanders, has proposed to her. Arthur, Jacob, and John are her sons. She is a widow. Example 18. Virginia Woolf, from Jacob's room. "How could I think of marriage?" she said to herself bitterly as she fastened the gate with a piece of wire. She had always disliked red hair in men, she thought, thinking of Mr. Floyd's appearance that night when the boys had gone to bed. And pushing her workbox away, she drew the blotting paper towards her and read Mr. Floyd's letter again. And her breast went up and down when she came to the word love. But not so fast this time, for she saw Johnny chasing the geese and knew that it was impossible for her to marry anyone, let alone Mr. Floyd, who was so much younger than she was. But what a nice man, and such a scholar, too. "Dear Mr. Floyd," she wrote. Did I forget about the cheese? She wondered, laying down her pen. No, she had told Rebecca that the cheese was in the hall. "I am much surprised," she wrote. But the letter which Mr. Floyd found on the table when he got up early next morning did not begin, "I am much surprised." And it was such a motherly, respectful, inconsequent, regretful letter that he kept it for many years, long after his marriage with Miss Wimbush of Andover, long after he had left the village. For he asked for a parish in Sheffield, which was given him, and, sending for Archer, Jacob, and John to say goodbye, he told them to choose whatever they liked in his study to remember him by. Archer chose a paper knife because he did not like to choose anything too good. Jacob chose the works of Byron in one volume. John, who was still too young to make a proper choice, chose Mr. Floyd's Kitten, which his brothers thought an absurd choice. But Mr. Floyd upheld him when he said, "It has fur like you." Then Mr. Floyd spoke about the King's Navy, to which Archer was going, and about Rugby, to which Jacob was going. And next day he received a silver salver and went first to Sheffield, where he met Miss Wimbush, who was on a visit to her uncle, then to Hackney, then to Maresfield House, of which he became the principal, and finally becoming editor of a well-known series of ecclesiastical biographies, he retired to Hampstead with his wife and daughter, and is often to be seen feeding the ducks on Leg of Mutton Pond. As for Mrs. Flanders's letter, when he looked for it the other day, he could not find it, and did not like to ask his wife whether she had put it away. Meeting Jacob in Piccadilly lately, he recognized him after 3 seconds. But Jacob had grown such a fine young man that Mr. Floyd did not like to stop him in the street. "Dear me," said Mrs. Flanders, when she read in the Scarborough and Harrogate Courier that the Reverend Andrew Floyd, etc., etc., had been made principal of Maresfield House, "that must be our Mr. Floyd." A slight gloom fell upon the table. Jacob was helping himself to jam. The postman was talking to Rebecca in the kitchen. There was a bee humming at the yellow flower which nodded at the open window. They were all alive, that is to say, while poor Mr. Floyd was becoming principal of Maresfield House. Mrs. Flanders got up and went over to the fender and stroked Topaz on the neck behind the ears. "Poor Topaz," she said, for Mr. Floyd's kitten was now a very old cat, a little mangy behind the ears, and one of these days would have to be killed. "Poor old Topaz," said Mrs. Flanders, as he stretched himself out in the sun. And she smiled, thinking how she had had him gelded, and how she did not like red hair in men. Smiling, she went into the kitchen. Jacob drew rather a dirty pocket handkerchief across his face. He went upstairs to his room. Now, the most astonishing and significant thing about this light-speed, single-paragraph biography is that it isn't really about Mr. Floyd at all. It's only there because it casts light on Jacob, the titular subject of the novel, on Jacob's world, and on Jacob's mother, whose voice begins and ends the book. The passage seems playful, and it is. It seems a wandering off, an irrelevance. A great deal of Jacob's room does. None of it is. Wolf omits the explanations and lets the connections make themselves. She affords an extreme and admirable example of both crowding and leaping. The novel leaps over years at a time, omitting great wads of the protagonist's life. He is seldom the viewpoint character, but we get dropped into the lively minds of many people whose connection with him is left implicit. There is no plot, and the structure is a series of seemingly random glimpses and vignettes. And yet the book moves from the first word to the stunning conclusion as surely and steadily as any Greek tragedy. Whatever she's talking about, Wolf's focus is always Jacob. She never strays from the center. Everything in the book contributes to the story she has to tell. Practice in this kind of paradoxical focus was part of the aim of Exercise 9, Part 3, Implication, and the Two Lumps. A discussion of story. I define story as a narrative of events, external or psychological, that moves through time or implies the passage of time and that involves change. I define plot as a form of story that uses action as its mode, usually in the form of conflict, and that closely and intricately connects one act to another, usually through a causal chain ending in a climax. Climax is one kind of pleasure. Plot is one kind of story. A strong, shapely plot is a pleasure in itself. It can be reused generation after generation. It provides an armature for narrative that beginning writers may find invaluable. But most serious modern fictions can't be reduced to a plot or retold without fatal loss except in their own words. The story is not in the plot, but in the telling. It is the telling that moves. Modernist manuals of writing often conflate story with conflict. This reductionism reflects a culture that inflates aggression and competition while cultivating ignorance of other behavioral options. No narrative of any complexity can be built on or reduced to a single element. Conflict is one kind of behavior. There are others equally important in any human life, such as relating, finding, losing, bearing, discovering, parting, changing. Change is the universal aspect of all these sources of story. Story is something moving, something happening, something or somebody changing. We don't have to have the rigid structure of a plot to tell a story, but we do need a focus. What is it about? Who is it about? This focus, explicit or implicit, is the center to which all the events, characters, sayings, doings of the story originally or finally refer. It may be or may not be a simple or a single thing or person or idea. We may not be able to define it. If it's a complex subject, it probably can't be expressed in any words at all except all the words of the story. But it is there. And a story equally needs what Jill Peyton Walsh calls a trajectory. Not necessarily an outline or synopsis to follow, but a movement to follow. The shape of a movement, whether it be straight ahead or roundabout or recurrent or eccentric, a movement that never ceases, from which no passage departs entirely or for long, and to which all passages contribute in some way. This trajectory is the shape of the story as a whole. It moves always to its end, and its end is implied in its beginning. Crowding and leaping have to do with the focus and the trajectory. Everything that is crowded in to enrich the story sensually, intellectually, emotionally, should be in focus, part of the central focus of the story. And every leap should be along the trajectory, following the shape and movement of the whole. I couldn't come up with an exercise specifically aimed at such large considerations about storytelling. But there's one last exercise that's good for us all, though we may not like it much. I shall call it Exercise 10, a terrible thing to do. Take one of the longer narrative exercises you wrote, anyone that went over 400 words, and cut it by half. If none of the exercises is suitable, take any piece of narrative prose you have ever written, 400 to 1,000 words, and do this terrible thing to it. This doesn't mean just cutting a bit here and there, snipping and pruning, though that's part of it. It means counting the words and reducing them to half that many, while keeping the narrative clear and the sensory impact vivid, not replacing specifics by generalities, and never using the word somehow. If there's dialogue in your piece, cut any long speech or long conversation in half just as implacably. This kind of cutting is something most professional writers have to do at one time or another. Just for that reason, it's good practice. But it's also a real act of self-discipline. It's enlightening. Forced to weigh your words, you find out which are the styrofoam and which are the heavy gold. Severe cutting intensifies your style, forcing you both to crowd and to leap. Unless you are unusually sparing with your words, or wise and experienced enough to cut as you write, revision will almost always involve some cutting of repetitions, unnecessary explanations, and so on. Consider using revision consciously as a time to consider what could go out if it had to. This may well include some of your favorite, most beautiful and admirable sentences and passages. You are allowed to cry or moan softly while you cut them. Anton Chekhov gave some advice about revising a story. First, he said, throw out the first three pages. As a young writer, I figured that if anybody knew about short stories, it was Chekhov, so I tried taking his advice. I really hoped he was wrong. But, of course, he was right. It depends on the length of the story, naturally. If it's very short, you can only throw out the first three paragraphs. But there are few first drafts to which Chekhov's razor doesn't apply. Starting a story, we all tend to circle around, explain a lot of stuff, set things up that don't need to be set up. Then we find our way and get going, and the story begins. Very often, just about on page three. In revision, as a rough rule, if the beginning can be cut, cut it. And if any passage sticks out in some way, leaves the main trajectory, could possibly come out, take it out and see what the story looks like that way. Often a cut that seemed sure to leave a terrible hole joins up without a seam. It's as if the story, the work itself, has a shape it's trying to achieve and will take that shape if you'll only clear away the verbiage. Waving goodbye from the pier. Some people see art as a matter of control. I see it mostly as a matter of self-control. It's like this. In me, there's a story that wants to be told. It is my end. I am its means. If I can keep myself, my ego, my wishes and opinions, my mental junk, out of the way, and find the focus of the story, and follow the movement of the story will tell itself. Everything I've talked about in this book has to do with being ready to let a story tell itself, having the skills, knowing the craft, so that when the magic boat comes by, you can step into it and guide it where it wants to go, where it ought to go. Appendix, the Peer Group Workshop. The writing workshop replaced the classroom teaching of creative writing, which all too often didn't work, with a practical technique based on the principle of mutual learning, which does work. That is, it works if the rules are followed. Free spirits who find that the self-control required by collaborative effort sets intolerable limits on their genius won't profit from a workshop. I wonder if I myself at 20 or 22 would have been willing to accept the discipline of a peer group if they had existed then. They didn't. The writing workshop, guided by a leader or a peer group, was invented long after I grew up. But that's true of a lot of things, including texting and kale chips, in which I am less interested. Online workshops offer an invaluable opportunity to writers who, for some reason, can't meet regularly, or at all, face-to-face with other writers. To form an online group, or join an existing one, can be a great thing for an isolated or housebound person who longs to share writing, criticism, and talk with other writers. I have experience as teacher and member only of actual workshops, but I hope my general observations and recommendations to an actual group will apply, with a bit of modification, to the procedure of a virtual group communicating online. The members. The optimum number of members for a peer group workshop is probably 6 or 7, up to 10 or 11. A group of less than 6 may find itself with too few differing opinions, and meetings with only 2 or 3 attending. A group of 12 or more must be prepared for a great deal to read every month and very long work sessions. Most groups meet once a month, scheduling meetings well ahead. A peer group works best if everybody in it is on pretty much the same level of accomplishment. A good deal of variation is tolerable and even valuable. But members working seriously at their craft will grow discouraged trying to work with people who are just playing at it with no real commitment, while the uncommitted will be bored by the serious ones. Experienced writers may feel that having to critique beginners' work is exploitation, while beginners may be daunted or oppressed by more experienced writers. Big differences in basic familiarity with written style, including punctuation, sentence structure, even spelling, can make such disparities awfully uncomfortable. Yet there are groups that contain wide disparities with no discomfort at all. The great thing is to find the right bunch of people, the people you can trust. Manuscripts. Sending manuscripts out to the group, once a process involving paper, stamps, time, and so on, is now a matter of clicking the send button. In the actual group, manuscripts should go out to everybody at least a week before the meeting or the agreed session date, so that they can be read and thought over and annotated. Manuscripts that arrive late will not receive critique till next time. The virtual group must decide whether to let critiquing begin whenever a manuscript is sent out and be carried on in a continuous intercorrespondence, or to limit discussion to a definite period, in consideration for members who have only limited time for reading and critiquing and their own writing. I recommend that you agree on a limit to the length of any one manuscript submitted to one session. Once you've found the right length, stick to it firmly. I suggest that it be a word limit, not a page limit, because wordy writers, deviously using small fonts and narrow margins, can cram 500 words on a page. If you meet in person, and if everybody in your group wants to hear a few pages of each manuscript read aloud before critique, by all means do so. It's often enjoyable to hear how the author's voice explains the piece. In a poetry workshop, reading aloud is SOP. For a prose narrative group, however, it may take too much time. Reading aloud is a performance, which may conceal flaws and unclarities. It goes by too fast for most hearers to make useful notes for critiquing, and, after all, the destiny of most prose narrative is to be read in silence. The piece has to explain itself on the page, speak for itself, make itself heard by the editor who decides to publish or not publish it, and by all its readers once it's published. Then, if it's a success, it might get an audio edition. If it was written seriously, it deserves to be read and considered seriously, in solitude, in silence. I consider that kind of slow, silent, thoughtful reading the greatest honor the group can do the piece. Reading the manuscripts. Everyone writes, everyone reads. That's the basic agreement on which the group stands or falls. Reading the other workshopper's work is as important to your membership in the group as writing and submitting your own work. Careless reading, delay in reading, and failure to read are forgivable only as occasional exceptions. Nitpicks, spelling, and grammar corrections, and small queries are best written directly on the manuscript, which is given back to the author to study at leisure. The online group must work out how to do this. One solution is for everybody to have the same editing software on their computer. Critiquing. It's an ugly, technical, useful word. But critiquing is the essential function of the writing group, along with the requirement of producing the manuscripts. Online, at present, unless people can Skype as a group, critiques must be written. In an actual group, notes and comments can be written on the manuscript or given to the author, but they should not replace spoken commentary and discussion. The critiquing session, the interchanges and interactions of the whole group in discussions, are very often the most valuable to the author. Rotation. Every person critiques every piece. Online, critiques may be read as they come in. Order isn't important. In an actual meeting, it is. Each manuscript submitted is critiqued in turn. Everyone in the group, except the author, speaks in turn. Ideally, free critique is possible. Only those who want to speak do, with no time limit on the critique and no order of rotation. But don't try it until you all know that nobody in the group is habitually silent or eternally blabby, and that nobody is allowed to dominate. Mutual respect and trust are absolutely essential to a workshop, and free critique does permit expansive egos to silence shyer ones. Many, perhaps most, peer groups do regular mutual critiquing for years using the right round the circle mode as the fairest and least stressful. Protocol. Each critique should be brief, without interruption from anyone else. Concerning important aspects of the piece, trivial quibbles should be written on the manuscript. Impersonal. Your knowledge of the author's character or intentions is absolutely irrelevant. It's the writing that's under discussion, not the writer. even if the piece is autobiographical, say, the narrator, not you. As you take your turn voicing or emailing your critique, avoid challenging the other critiquers. No sneers, no put-downs, no flame-throwing. Enlarge the group discussion without repeating. If you agree with Jane's comment, say so. If you disagree with what Bill said, say so without animosity, and explain how and why you disagree. Remember that first impressions, reactions from a first reading, even misunderstandings, can be extremely useful. After all, when the author submits the piece to an editor, everything may depend on that editor's first impressions. Don't feel stupid about saying or sending naive reactions or questions, but take care that they're spoken or written without animosity and with the sole purpose of trying to improve the manuscript. Criticism tends to focus on what's wrong. To be useful, negative criticism should indicate the possibility of revision. Tell the writer where you were confused or surprised or annoyed or delighted, which parts you like best. It's at least as useful to the author to hear what works, what's right. Savage negative judgments on the whole quality of the piece may arouse the author's anger and refusal to listen, or may do real and lasting harm. The sadistic practice of the critic who assumes the privilege of dismissing work as utterly worthless, the idea that critical judgment can be absolute, the notion that abuse makes people artists, all that still exists but has no place whatever in a workshop. The peer group, founded on mutual trust and respect, rejects both the domineering ego and the self-abasing sycophant. Address the author, not the others. You may ask the author only a direct, factual, yes or no question, and you may ask it only if you tell the group your question first and get their consent to ask it. The reason for this is that others in the group may not want the question answered. Let's say you want to ask, "Did you mean for us not to know who Della's mother is?" Others may prefer to read the text as if they didn't know the author and couldn't ask questions, as we read most narratives and judge it from that basis. Never ask the author a question that requires a long explanation or defense. If the text itself doesn't answer the question, the most useful thing you can do may be to make a note calling attention to the problem, which the author can then fix when revising. Suggestions for how to fix something may be valuable, but should be offered respectfully. Even if you're sure you see just how it ought to be changed, this story belongs to its author, not to you. Don't say what the story reminds you of in literature or the movies. Respect the text as itself. Consider what this story is about, what it tries to do, how it fulfills itself, how it might achieve its ends better. If you have some members whose critiques are habitually long-winded, the actual group may have to get a kitchen timer and limit each critique to a few minutes. And the virtual group may have to set a word limit. A group that tolerates egocentric, tiresome, blabby critiquing probably won't stay together long. Intensity is essential. Interplay is essential. In the actual group, when people keep their critiques short, the session may end with a general, free discussion, often the best part of it all. I imagine something similar happens with online interactions. In such free discussion, the group may arrive at a sense of the meeting, but it may end in a dozen different opinions and be just as useful and exciting. Being critiqued. The rule of silence. Before and during the entire session, the author of the story under discussion is silent. as author, offer no preliminary explanations or excuses. If asked to answer a question, be sure the whole group is willing for you to do so, and be as brief as is humanly possible. While being critiqued, make notes of what people say about your story. Even if the comments seem stupid, they may make sense later. Note any comment that keeps coming up from different people. Do the same with online critique. When all the discussion of your piece is over, you may speak if you want to. Keep it brief. Don't go into defense mode. If you have a question about your story that wasn't addressed, ask it now. By far the best response to your hard-working critics is, "Thank you." The rule of silence seems arbitrary. It isn't. It is an essential, sometimes I think the essential, element of the process. It's almost impossible for an author whose work is being criticized not to be on the defensive, eager to explain, answer, point out, "Oh, but see, what I meant was, oh, I was going to do that in the next draft." If you aren't allowed to do this, you won't waste time, yours and theirs, trying to do it. Instead, you will listen. Because you can't answer, you won't be busy mentally preparing what you're going to say in answer. All you can do is hear. You can hear what people got from your piece, what they think needs some work, what they misunderstood and understood, disliked and liked about it. And that's what you're there for. Working online, if you keep the rule of silence and do not reply to critique, the critiquers will reply to one another. Their criticisms are likely to change, develop, deepen during this interchange. Your job is to read them and think and make notes. And at the end, say thanks. If you truly can't endure the rule of silence, probably you don't really want to know how other people respond to your work. You choose to be the first and last judge of it. In this case, you won't fit happily in a group. This is absolutely okay. It's a matter of temperament. Some artists can work only in solitude. There may be periods in an artist's life when they need the stimulus and feedback of a group, and periods when they do better working alone. Always, in the last analysis, on your own or in a group, you are your own judge, and you make your own decisions. The discipline of art is freedom.